Hello, patrons. No Sarah Lane today, because you haven't quite got there yet. But we're getting really, 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 really close. We made a lot more progress this weekend than I expected. You guys are the best. But we do have Rob Reed today.
Hello, hello.
Rob's getting prepped, looking over the stories. Patrick Beige is here as well.
Oh, that's true.
I am here.
And Roger Chang.
Hello.
And I'm ready to talk about all of these things.
All of the things. All the things. So, yes.
No, I was going to say, I have a reasonable understanding of basic quantum mechanics. And I've seen and read a few things about quantum computers, but I still don't understand that.
Well, so maybe you'll understand it better after our chit-chat, or you could listen to an hour-long discussion on this topic between me and Steve Jurvetson, who knows more about this than anybody I know.
How do you measure the spin of the atom when the whole Heisenberg uncertainty principle? I still can't wrap my head.
Astonishingly, and I was flabbergasted when I learned this, they measure the spin with a common yardstick.
Well, it can't be that common.
A common yardstick, yeah. You just,
well, initially it's
very common. Closely. It's got to be very well calibrated.
Because mine's kind of, worn down on the edge. Mine wouldn't work.
No, it's common initially.
But then it's larger electrons. The larger electrons can usually measure up pretty reasonably by a yardstick.
Yeah. Well, you can know the position or the velocity, not both. So Heisenberg's uncertainty principle only stops you from measuring both things at once. It doesn't stop you
precisely
from measuring.
Yeah. Unless you use a yardstick and a meter stick. If you use a metric measuring device and an English
this
system,
is why
then
I've
you
been saying we should go metric for years.
Yeah.
You can measure both. Just if the more precise you get with one, the less precise you get with the other.
I was about to say precisely, but I stopped myself. But yes, you're correct. You are entirely correct.
Roger's like, no, seriously, guys, I really wanted to know the answer to that question.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I just sent an email. I didn't really.
Just go listen to the hour-long talk between Rob and.
I'll find a YouTube video on it or something.
Hey, there is an entire hour of podcasting majesty available to you, Roger. You can learn all about this stuff on the Afron podcast.
I started to finally understand quantum supremacy after that, listening to Jurvetson and you talk.
Yeah.
Wait a second. Are we going to go into politics?
Politics. Yes,
the quantum supremacy theory that the quantum nation is an exception.
Those
nation.
Quantum supremacists, I tell you, they are.
We must preserve the quantum hegemony.
Or must we? We can't know.
At the same time.
Well, by happy coincidence, the guest on my podcast episode today is Estonian. So that brings an interesting dimension.
Jurvetson's Estonian? Really?
He is Estonian.
Oh, nice.
I mean, he's American. He's of Estonian descent.
Right, but he's Estonian-American.
He is of Estonian descent.
He's a stoned American.
I think his mom
has a great accent. I mean, his parents came over from there.
Oh, wow.
I spent a couple of days in Estonia this weekend. And
wow.
I thought that made me the foremost expert on the topic we're going to discuss on the show. But clearly, you've spoken to an Estonian person for an hour. So,
yes.
I mean, I bow.
Well, a person of Estonian descent. But yeah.
Right. Okay. So maybe that balances it out. Maybe we're both great experts.
So you spent a couple of days in Estonia this weekend. Isn't that all of the weekend?
Well,
it was an Estonian weekend. They're longer than
they are. Yes, because they're metric weekends.
Right.
Yes. Exactly. I'm gonna go grab a glass of water.
Okay.
Or
you're going to both grab and not grab a glass of water at the same time?
You're going to be in superposition with respect to the water.
And thus the possibilities branch from that point forward.
They do indeed.
I have to say, this screen is really nice on the essential.
Is that
phone.
The
yeah. It's the essential.
Wait, the screen is really nice?
Yeah.
Really? I thought it was terrible from what I read in this article.
Oh no, you have to freeze and crack it if you want to actually get inside the phone. According to iFixit. I think that may be what you're thinking.
And that might impinge on the awesomeness of
the screen. You have to freeze and crack this beautiful screen. But just don't break it and you'll be fine. It's very responsive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yes, you can't repair it. Yes, the customer support is apparently awful right now, but otherwise, it's an excellent phone.
Oh, what is it? Is it the essential?
Yeah.
MKBHD said, save your money.
Yep. And I kind of agree so far, although I've only had it for a couple hours. So.
Doesn't it have like a black and white camera?
First version?
A black and white camera?
Yeah, no, I think it's got a monochrome sensor.
Oh, yes. You don't mean only a black and white camera.
No. Like,
no, you're right. It does. Yeah.
Specifically for black and white photography.
Right. It does.
Yeah.
It has a supplemental sensor for that. You're right.
What is supposed to be so awesome about the essential phone? Like how I know it's Andy Rubin, so that's a big deal, but what's sort of their pitch for why you should get this rather than the one of the trillion other?
No, the idea was like it's simple, right? So like the Pixel from Google, it's just Android. They haven't messed it up with a bunch of stuff. And it's built from the ground up to be a beautiful phone. So solid engineering. That's their pitch. You're going to get the greatest phone at this price point with no BS getting in your way. You'll have stock Android. It's supposed to be the phone for Android lovers.
And just like the Pixel.
I mean, kind of, right? That's the problem is I'm looking at this. I'm like, that's a really nice screen. Also, the Samsung Note and Galaxy have really nice screens too.
Yeah.
I mean, they're
have bloatware.
They were winning the war on bezels until the Note came out, I think. Mm. There's almost no bezel on this.
Ah, the bezel war. The great bezel wars. Yes.
The bezel wars are underway.
Yeah. You know, I've been looking at the LG V30, which also has a super thin bezel, and it sort of struck me that indeed the bezel wars started. Because it's the kind of thing you don't really notice. And then after not so long, like 10 months, most of the flagships have no bezel. And you look back from you look at the phones that came out just 18 months ago and you're like, wow, that looks old. That's so 2017.
Eileen has an old iPhone 4 constantly charging because she wants to get some photos off it. One of these days, by gosh, I know she's got but every time I pass by it, it looks older every time. I'm like, oh my God, I think the bezels got bigger since the last time I looked at it.
It's also thick, compared to the half a millimeter they shave off every second version makes those old ones. Oh, it's incredible. Imagine that, technological items looking older as time progresses.
What a crazy thought. I say as I grab my ThinkPad T42. Oh, it's not over there anymore.
Damn it, that would have been a great prop.
Yeah. Well, we're not on video anyway, but I do have this Mattel Electronics basketball game.
Are we not on video? I thought that some people saw it on video.
No, not yet. I haven't started the broadcast, so the only
we're the only people seeing one another.
Yeah, the only thing being recorded right now is audio.
Oh, I thought that the people who are watching live saw video.
Yeah, once I start the broadcast, they will. But I haven't.
Right.
You mean at this instant. Got it. You're not talking about in the future, in 2018. You're talking
In 2 minutes, I will start the video.
And what percentage of your consumers of the podcast would you estimate watch the video versus listen to the audio?
10, maybe 20% these days.
It's a pretty high number.
Yeah.
Really?
And when is the consumption happened? Does it happen the next morning for the most part? Does it happen?
Yeah.
So it's pretty much tomorrow morning that people will
consumption of the podcast video or audio generally happens in the morning.
The next day.
Yeah. There's almost, I hate to say this for the live people, but there's almost nobody who watches live percentage-wise. and then we get a large chunk who watch it because they know when it's out and they watch it immediately.
Yep.
or listen to it immediately. And then I think it kind of drops off and it's next morning for everybody else.
So would you guesstimate it's single-digit percentage who consume it day of and most people consume it the following day?
No, I'd say it's double-digit percentage day of. I don't know what to guess. Maybe 30% day of.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's pretty big.
Yeah.
Pretty big, yeah.
It's a smaller chunk, but it's a chunk.
Yeah, that's
it's
a good
single
chunk.
It's single-digit for the number of people watching live.
Got it. Yeah.
Speaking
of. So if we make any horrible mistakes,
yeah,
it could be fixed before the entire world starts mocking us.
Hello. We are live on the video now. And if you are a person who backs us on Patreon and gets the full pre-show audio, you know we've been talking about going live on video for several minutes now.
We don't want to rush into anything without considering it very carefully.
Yes, exactly. Roger, you have control.
Is that
over
a general statement?
Right?
Mission control statement, yeah. Roger has control over himself and others. So we have made it more than halfway from where we were to our new goal since we last spoke on Friday, which is amazing. Thank you to everyone who has upped their support or begun their support. We are very, very close to hitting the goal of bringing Sarah Lane on and adding DTNS Labs and a monthly roundtable show. And it's exciting.
Exciting.
And it's very exciting. And we're excited to have Rob here, too.
It's great to be here.
So excited. Just can't.
Uh-oh. Takedown notice.
Was it? Oh, that I think that's a compliment.
It is. It is. Your rendition was so good. It would fool
spot on
content ID into taking down our.
I mean, really? I mean, if someone was that good.
For JPEG, or who was it? No, BioCow said DTNS has upped their offerings, so up yours. That's an old joke, but it still makes me laugh. And then Ethan Kane, who does our show notes, says, I promise to do better show notes. That's all I got. That's fine. You're doing great. You're good. You're fine. Don't worry about it. Zoe Brings Bacon is going to pay extra in bacon. Awesome. I think Sarah's a vegetarian, but that's okay. I'll eat the bacon. Patrick eats bacon. You eat bacon, right?
Oh, yeah, but mostly in the U.S. Although, I guess I do eat bacon here sometimes. But this is one of my great joys. When I travel to the U.S., it's hotel buffet breakfast with lots of delicious crispy bacon. Yes, of course. What do you mean, really? Do you not enjoy the bacon from hotel breakfast buffets?
It's all right. It's not the best.
Well, it might not be the best.
I was thinking about this when I was booking my hotel for England. I was thinking about this, like, ooh, I get to have that lovely English breakfast. And I'm like, I wonder if people in England think it's any good, because I don't think our breakfasts are very good here at hotels.
Honestly,
but then I remembered that you have said this before.
Yeah, but that rule doesn't apply to the UK. Pretty much no one thinks UK food is breakfast or... Yeah, but you're American.
I love English breakfast. Oh, shots fired. Listen, buddy.
Yes?
Thanks for that statue, but what have you done for us lately?
Well, I think food-wise, I mean, I love McDonald's, but I think food-wise.
See, you
have such a weird obsession with, like, junk food.
You're like, you play the French card of, oh, we have such better food, but then you're like, I love McDonald's. I love breakfast buffets at hotels. I love nachos with the gooey
cheese.
It's
like McDonald's and Jerry Lewis. Why do the French kick what they kick from our culture?
All right. We're gonna have to finish this after the show.
All right.
You guys ready?
Control.
You've got it. I already gave it to you. Here we go.
Do you like listening to advertisements? Me neither. Want to help and support creators directly? Then head to dailytechnewsshow.com/support and help us reach our new milestone today.
This is the Daily Tech News for Tuesday, September 5th, 2017. I'm Tom Merritt, Patrick Beja alongside. How are you, sir?
I am excellent and excited to talk about quantum things.
Yes, Rob Reed, author of After On, is and is not here. He is in superposition for us. Thank you, Rob.
I am in superposition. I am in this and at least one other universe right now.
I tell you what, we're in superposition having you on the show. That's what I would like to say.
All right.
No, we're going to talk about quantum computing because Rob has a great episode of After On, the podcast, up with Steve Jurvetson talking about quantum computing. So we're going to mine Rob's knowledge of that and point you there if you want to find out a little more. Hopefully you'll understand a little more about quantum computing by the end of this episode. Roger Chang, our producer, is here as well. How's it going, Roger?
Good.
Let's start with a few tech things you should know. Xiaomi announced its upcoming Mi A1 smartphone will run Google's Android One platform, its first device not to use Xiaomi's own Android-based MIUI. The 5.5-inch Mi A1 will be available September 12th in 40 markets. In India is the only price we have, 14,999 rupees there. It's about $230 US.
Pretty good get for the Android One platform, I would say.
Yeah, definitely.
YouTube now allows iPhone users who have 100 or more subscribers to stream directly from their phone's screen, something Android users have been able to do for a while. Microsoft's Mixer Create launched out of beta last week, allowing gamers to stream from iOS and Android.
This is the big thing, letting you stream your phone's screen so you can show people your text messages. No, that's for games. I know.
It's mostly about games, yeah.
WhatsApp announced it plans to offer services to large enterprises for a fee, like easier ways to respond to customer messages or delivery updates, flight times, stuff like that. WhatsApp also announced a closed pilot program for verifying businesses with a little green check mark.
WhatsApp needs money. Interesting.
Yes, finally, a monetization strategy. All right, here's some more top stories. A Reddit thread verified by Fandroid.com shows China listed in the Google Play Developer Console as an option for distributing an app. Now, you've been able to distribute an app in Hong Kong, but this is China, mainland China. Also, several Chinese firewall test sites, and I tested three of them, show play.google.com as available in China, even though www.google.com is not. Google's been blocked there for a long time now. This is interesting. Patrick, you found this Fandroid story, and it shocked me that it's true.
Yeah, it appears to be. I mean, there's something happening there. Yeah. It's not 100%.
We don't know what it means, but these two facts are true. The developer console has this, and it appears to be unblocked from the Great Firewall.
And it's not like Google is staging a huge comeback to China at the moment, at least. But even just the Play Store being available in China is huge. Of course, China is a gigantic market and they use smartphones a lot. Apple has been bending over backwards to be present in the country for a while. The interesting thing here is that this was basically a moral stance that Google took. It was about 10 years ago when they left the country. It was the website at the time, but still. So it would be interesting to see. It stands to reason, and it would make it would be logical that if they do come back to China, even with just the Play Store, they would need to comply with many of the regulations that they were taking a stance against when they left. So
I would not see them compromise that stance with search results listing. That's where they drew their line. We will not change search results just because you don't like certain search results. So to get Google Play going, they would have to either say that independent Android installations can access the store, which would fundamentally change the way Google has marketed its Android releases, or would have to remove search from the Android package put, you know, Alibaba there or something instead.
Yeah, it's not just that, though. It's also things like, you know, China banned VPNs just a few weeks ago. Then that would mean those wouldn't be available. And that's kind of, yes, it's not, you know, censoring search per se, but it is doing something that they... It could be argued that they were kind of against morally before, even if it's not exactly to the letter to what they were doing. All right, YouTube-MP3.org reached a settlement in its ongoing litigation with the RIAA. Both parties asked the court to rule in favor of the labels on a copyright claim. Site owner Philip Maitzans, Maytsans will pay an unspecified settlement as well as face an injunction preventing development of similar stream ripping service or technology and transfer the domain name to the labels.
Yeah, so this decision is mostly about inducement, right? This goes all the way back to the old e-donkey and such, where if you are basically telling people you can pirate things by using your service, you don't get to claim, you know, we just provided software that turned one thing into another on the internet. We didn't know. I mean, it was called youtube-mp3.org. It was very avowedly saying we can take the YouTube stream and turn it into an MP3. There's nothing fundamentally illegal about taking a stream off the internet and screen capturing it or recording it. It's what you do with it afterwards that's the issue, right? I mean, Rob, you wrote an entire novel about copyright. You also founded Rhapsody. I have a feeling you might have some insight on this.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of these things where if the if YouTube-mp3.com, which is what probably a trademark violation along with a certain number of copyright violations and so forth, if they had unlimited resources with which to fight this thing, it's conceivable that they could have brought it to some crazy distant endpoint in the court system, but who in the world is going to finance that lawsuit? It's interesting to note that even Napster never actually lost per se. They basically ran out of steam in terms of their ability to battle. But as you'd said, the defense on this one would have to rest on the notion that there were really legitimate, substantial, non-infringing uses for this technology. And if only by naming it as they did, they kind of obviated that defense. Now, one of the things that's interesting, there's two things that are interesting to me about this case. One of them is this sort of grim reality for the founder, and they don't actually specify what it is, that he is personally liable for part of what, you know, the undisclosed settlement is. And technically, that could be as much as $150,000 per copy per song. So that could be a very long-lasting bankruptcy for this particular person. It's probably much more likely that they just wanted to get the thing off the air, create an example, and not necessarily, you know, put this guy in penury for all of time. But, you know, who really knows? The other thing that's interesting is IFPI, which is the international version of the RIAA, recently said that the stream ripping has gotten to the point where 50% of people between the ages of 16 and 24 engage in it. Far more people than are actually downloading from pirated sites. So I think what we're seeing here is kind of another round in the never-ending game of whack-a-mole that the rights holders play when a mechanism for accessing music in a way they don't want them to access music gets to a point of critical mass. They set an example, they inject a lot of friction into that particular way of accessing the music, and it probably gets batted down. I was surprised that such a high percentage, 50%, is a colossal number of people in the key age group of 16 to 24 were allegedly using this software or software like it over the last 6 months.
Well, it may mean only one or two things, right? So it doesn't mean that 50% are getting all their music this
way.
No. But even that is a high amount of people who've tried it once, right?
It means there's incredible fluency and comfort with this mechanism out there. I mean, 50% of people at that age may not even have driven yet. Like, that's a high, high percentage of folks. That just means that it's ubiquitous. Like, everybody knows how to do this.
iFixit has given the Essential Phone a repairability rating of 1. by comparison, the iPhone and the Google Pixel have repairability ratings of 7. Even the Samsung Galaxy S8, which is not terribly repairable, has a rating of 4. iFixit had to freeze and crack the screen to gain entry in order to try to assess what is inside the Essential. iFixit wrote, "Any attempt at repair is likely to inflict as much damage as it fixes. Several components are integrated with others, meaning that breaking one can mean breaking the other. The earpiece speaker is the same module as the selfie camera. The USB-C port is soldered to the motherboard, etc., etc." I got my Essential phone today. I have to say, it's a very pretty screen. There are a lot of pretty screens out there, but this one is very nice. It's continuing the war on bezels with, you know, the bezel-less thing. The notch for the camera at the top doesn't bother me at all, but there's also not anything that, and I've only had it for a couple hours, but there's nothing that's blown me away about it. It is a very solid build. It feels good in the hand and all that, but I don't know. I mean,
it's surprising that it gets such a different rating because you would think it's not significantly thinner or smaller or more compact than other phones, right? So you would think if they mash everything together, that's to gain space. I guess it is kind of smaller than an iPhone.
It's a bit tinier than the iPhone, but mostly in the bezel, not in the screen.
Right. Going from 7 to 1 would, I don't know. It is surprising. I didn't expect it to have just...
Well, the thing that they don't mention in the article is going from 7 to 1, it is actually on a scale of 10,000. So they're all really, really hard.
They're all really bad, yeah.
Really hard to pick. And I got actually, I'm presuming it's a 10-point scale. That was a joke. But I've got to say, it must feel a little ironic when you're freezing and shattering a screen and your name is iFixit. You're not fixing it, man.
That's how they get the one. They're like, this is not fixing. This is not what fixing feels like. Yeah.
This is not what fixing is all about. Yeah.
Thursday, researchers notified Estonia, the country, of a vulnerability in the chip used in the 750,000 or so identification cards issued after October 17, 2014. Estonian ID cards used before this date and mobile IDs are unaffected. Estonia's Information System Authority says it has initial solutions for risk mitigation and no exploits of the vulnerability have been reported. Early and online voting begins in Estonia on October 5th.
And thank you to T2T2, by the way, who pointed out this story in our subreddit at dailytechnewsshow.reddit.com. He is in Estonia. He runs a bunch of the servers for diamondclub.tv and helps out a lot with all of that, including the chat room. He is Estonian, but Patrick, you're our leading Estonian expert on staff here because you visited Estonia for 36 hours recently.
Yeah, it was just last weekend. I spent about 36 hours in Tallinn, the capital of the country. And so I think it makes me uniquely qualified to comment on that story. And what I will say is that I do appreciate the kind of response that we got from the officials, at least as we're reading it in the articles covering this. It seems that like the kind of story that would throw most countries in a panic, but the way they're talking about it is so calm and reassuring and exactly the way I think those kinds of crises should be managed. They're saying, yes, it is a concern. We're looking into it. It's not so damaging that we think an entire recall of the ID cards should be taking place, which implies, you know, if it was necessary, they would initiate it. And they have mitigation policies being put in place. They really know what they do with all of this. They have the experts. This is how you should handle a security issue because those will always happen.
Yes.
And it's very, I guess it's a stark contrast with what I think we would have seen in other countries if that had happened.
Possibly. And Patrick, I think it's worth pointing out, and we were talking about this before the show, but the fact that you were in Estonia right before this hack happened is completely coincidental, correct?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it has been reported on, I think, a while ago. So I could in no way have been connected to this. Absolutely.
And the fact that you knew quite a few things about how the hack was perpetrated that hasn't been in any articles yet is, again, just it's your superior research chops.
Entirely. Actually, I would like to vehemently deny the claims that I knew anything about these hacks before they were reported.
Good. I just wanted to make sure everybody was perfectly clear on that.
I've seen these claims floating around the internet and they have no basis in reality.
Now you guys have pointed out something, which is our narrative in our heads when we hear these stories is a hack has been perpetrated. That's exactly what you said.
Yeah.
No hack has been perpetrated. Researchers found a chip level vulnerability, which is both great and awful. It's great because you want researchers to find it. This is a good news story, which is the researchers figured out something before the bad guys did, And hopefully we get it fixed before the bad guys can take advantage of it.
Only they were North Korean researchers, Tom.
No, they were not North Korean researchers, Rob. Are you sure? I'm pretty sure about that. I'm 100% sure about that.
I mean, are we sure they were not North Korean?
Yes.
The article did not specify their rest.
I'm going to rest that the probabilities are that they are not secretly North Korean researchers either.
The article was suspiciously silent on whether or not they were North Koreans. So?
I think we're doing a great job at restoring the kind of suspicion and hysteria that yes. should accompany these kinds of stories, no. and that suspiciously does not.
I mean, and if you really want to have something bad to pull out of this story, it's that it's chip level vulnerability. And T2T2 pointed that out in our chat room just now. It's a defect which can affect billions of chip cards, right? Because it's not just Estonia that used this kind of chip in their cards.
Yeah, and I will also point out something that I did actually feel and discuss with some people while I was in Estonia this weekend, so it did bring something. For those who aren't aware, Estonia is very close to Russia, and it has constant issues with Russia, you know, trying to steer stuff up. And with the election coming, I think they're taking this potential issue very, very, very seriously.
And Estonia has actually experienced, I think both Estonia and Georgia at different times have experienced fairly massive hacking attacks that folks suspected came out of Russia at different points of geopolitical tension in the last several years. And of course, it was part of the Soviet Union unwillingly for, you know, a couple of generations. And it can be very tense there. I mean, you look at a globe and the enormity and proximity of Russia to Estonia is just wow.
Yeah, it's 1.5 million people in the country, entire country of Estonia. So
finally, Kotaku passed along sales figures from retail tracker MediaCrate showing that Nintendo sold 1.5 million Switch units in Japan in 26 weeks. In comparison, at the same point after launch, the PS4 from Sony had only sold 665,760 units. It took 69 weeks to hit the 1.5 million point in Japan. And at the same time, Nintendo has courted controversy by changing the biography of Mario online to say he also seems to have worked as a plumber a long time ago.
So I think that last part there is highly suspicious, and I do think we need to inquire a little bit more about that change and why Nintendo is trying to revisit history in that way. But okay, more seriously, talking about the Switch, the comparison to the PS4 is a little bit not artificial, but the PS4 had a very slow start compared to other consoles in the country, mainly due to the great success of mobile platforms there. So it's not super fair. However, the success of the Switch is kind of undeniable worldwide and also in Japan, which this does illustrate. And it's even more undeniable and delightful because it was unexpected. You know, we were talking about the Switch a year ago thinking, how is this going to go? This is kind of possibly the last attempt that Nintendo has to stay in the manufacturing, in the console making business. And it's been an incredible success for the console, mainly resting on the laurels of Zelda, I would venture to say. I'm guessing, you know, about half of the people who bought a Switch bought it for Zelda when it first came out, which underscores the importance of great content when you launch a platform. But yeah, the story of the Nintendo Switch continues to astonish and delight lovers of the game industry because, of course, we all have a fond history with the company as we grew up.
I mean, PS3s were still working very well when the PS4 came out. Nintendo Wii U's, I mean, they're working fine, but not nearly as widespread or popular. So you had more of a hunger, I think, for a good Nintendo console, if I can sum up some of what you were saying there. Hey, folks, if you want to get all the tech headlines each day in about 5 minutes, be sure to subscribe to Daily Tech Headlines at dailytechheadlines.com, on your Amazon Echo, and in the Anchor app at anchor.fm. Now, as we mentioned, Rob got a chance to chat with Steve Jurvetson about quantum computing in the After On podcast, which I am also on, talking about the book After On, if you want to check that out at after-on.com. And at the 4th International Conference on Quantum Technologies in Moscow back in July, Harvard University's Mikhail Lukin and a team of U.S. and Russian scientists working together presented a test of a 51-qubit device, which sets a landmark in the race for something called quantum supremacy. Now, listening to your talk with Jurvetson helped me kind of wrap my head around quantum supremacy, but can you sort of explain what that means? Are we just talking about, you know, being number one? What is quantum supremacy?
Quantum supremacy, it different people have somewhat different definitions, and so some might quibble with this, but basically quantum supremacy is a notional threshold that we will one day cross and that we have seemed to be teetering on the brink of for quite some time now, depending on who you talk to, which says a quantum system is now doing things that are essentially impossible for a classical system to do. And some people hair split the difference, the definition a little bit differently. I think a common complaint about quantum systems is that for the most part, they are operating against sort of trumped up problems, things like boson sampling, and it's strange things that wouldn't really have much of an everyday purpose. And the notion of quantum supremacy is like, aha, quantum computing has gotten to the point where it's doing something that's functionally interesting, and it's doing it in a way that classical computing essentially cannot touch. And, you know, some folks say, well, when you get to 50 qubits, you've attained quantum supremacy, and that's one of the things that drove this particular article, because I think a Russian group demonstrated a 51-qubit system. That was probably a little bit of an arbitrary threshold. But generally, it means quantum computing has come of age, and it's doing things that aren't just stunts, but are genuinely useful problems that could not be solved in another manner.
Yeah, and there's a couple of different ways of going about quantum computing. Some sort of like D-Wave combine it with classical computing. Others like the Google effort or this Harvard effort are going simply saying, what can we do with the number of qubits that we can make happen?
Right.
But how is it different from normal computing? What do you get out of it?
Well, so basically, the fundamentally bizarre thing that's going on under the hood with quantum computing is they use the term classical computer, which means just computer as we know it. A classical computer will have a bit in one of two states. It'll be either a zero or a one, right? We all know that. So if you have an 8-bit string, it can be in one of 256 configurations. The quantum computer can literally be in all 256 of those states simultaneously, which is a pretty powerful thing when you're solving certain types of problems, and particularly when you start getting into strings that go far, far, far beyond 8 bits or 8 qubits. And so the fundamental unit in quantum computing is called a qubit. I think that's what they measured the ark with in the Old Testament of the Bible, if I'm not mistaken.
Spelled
as well.
A little differently, but yeah, it's
different
same.
Qubit.
Yeah, sounds the different, same.
Different qubit. And so a qubit is one of these things that's in what's called in quantum terms superposition, which means it's two different things at once. And it can even be gradations in between those two different things at once. And again, for particular kinds of problems, that's exceptionally powerful. It can be exceptionally powerful in cryptography. If you imagine you have a very, very long string that you need to crack, the ability to test gazillions, and that's a technical term, of different possibilities simultaneously becomes very, very powerful. It's not a big deal to be able to test 256 things simultaneously, because obviously a fast classical computer can test 256 combinations stepwise very, very rapidly. A quantum system, though, can do them all simultaneously. Now, Tom, you also mentioned that there's sort of two different approaches. The biggest company in quantum computing is called D-Wave Systems. And they have qubit counts in the thousands. Like the most recent D-Wave system to ship says, basically quotes 2,000 qubits. When you see a lot of other articles about people trying to do things with quantum, you'll see qubit counts in the teens and 20s or 50-ish. And that's because they're taking two very different approaches. Basically, what D-Wave does is it's a little bit less of a pure approach, and it's almost more like having an ASIC. So their systems are designed around particular problems, and they're able to up their qubit counts for that reason, but it's not precisely apples to apples with when you see a truly pure, maybe platonic ideal of a quantum system that might have more like a few dozen qubits.
Now, we've talked about this before, and I got an email from a guy named Liam one time attempting to refine the explanation of why quantum computing works the way it does. I'm going to read this because I think it's a really good explanation.
Yep.
And then I want you to give us the somewhat easier to stand, if maybe a little fuzzier in accuracy, version of this. Liam says, quantum mechanics allows for probabilities to be complex numbers rather than just real numbers between 0 and 1. So it's what you were talking about, being able to have more possibilities. In classical probability, if an event can happen in two ways, you add up the probabilities of those two ways, and the resulting probability that is more likely is the one. But in quantum mechanics, sometimes when you add up those probabilities, they cancel each other out and the event doesn't happen. So the goal in quantum computing with those 256 possibilities is to set things up so that the probabilities of the wrong answers cancel each other out, and then you end up getting the right answer like that. This is tricky, and we only know how to do that for a few specific problems. That's why the limited number of applications that you heard Rob talking about. One of those problems is integer factorization using Shor's algorithm, which is why quantum computers could be used to break encryption. Now, that is very good and probably a more accurate way of describing quantum computers, but it's still going to confuse some people. So I really still like, and I know Liam takes issue with this, but I really still like your explanation of how it's able to do this.
Oh, it's not mine. It is Steve Jurvetson's. I am merely parroting what the master says. And so this is just a quick shout out. As Tom mentioned, I've been doing a podcast series that's connected to my novel After On. And it's basically a series of 8 episodes that go deep into the tech and the science connected to the novel, deeper than I could within the story, without making a very tedious story. And what I do is I sit down with people who are far smarter than me and far deeper in their domains than I am to talk about subjects that are significant in the book. And one of the subjects that's significant in the novel is quantum computing. And so I sat down. Now, this is actually a shout out to another story we just had with Steve Jurvetson, a well-known venture capitalist who has backed Elon Musk in ventures including Tesla and SpaceX. And in our podcast episode, which went up today, Steve and I do talk a bit about Elon, but we really get deep into quantum computing because he has been on the board of D-Wave Systems, the biggest quantum computing company in the world, for 15 years. So that's a long path for a venture capitalist. So everybody who thinks that, you know, the path to liquidity in high tech is always lightning fast, sometimes it's a decade and a half. Anyway, fun coincidence, Steve Jurvetson, Estonian. So, you know, kind of a shout out for a recent story. I must add, he is of Estonian descent. He is not personally Estonian. I believe he has a California driver's license and not one of these potentially compromised IDs. But the way
I would say that that provides the perfect cover for someone like you
to
do things that you might suggest other people on this show might have done. I'm just, you know.
I was not the one in Estonia right before all of this stuff happens. And if memory serves, you were in Houston a couple weeks ago, too. Like, very, very suspicious travel patterns there. So anyway, the way that Steve conceptualizes and the way that people who are very, very deep in the quantum sphere, you know, basically explain how in the world does this happen? How is it that this quantum system is in, you know, many, many different states simultaneously? And the way that Steve puts it, somewhat playfully, but actually quite seriously as well, is that there's two explanations, really. The first one is that there is a very large set of all but identical quantum computers to our quantum computer in parallel universes. And they're all testing one combination. Somebody gets the right combination, and we certainly hope that it's us. And it gets a little bit complex as to whether or not the solution then radiates through all of the parallel universes or if we just get to hog it to ourselves. But basically the notion is, in order for this to work, you literally have a vast set of parallel universes with identical quantum computers working on the system. And D-Wave has made, according to Steve in today's podcast, the audacious claim that they have harnessed the compute resources of trillions of universes in solving problems for their customers. So that is explanation number one. Explanation number two, again, which, according honestly, to Steve,
if I can interrupt for just a second, it sounds like the most American capitalism thing to say ever. We have harnessed the powers of trillions of universes to solve the problem of the consumer. It's beautiful.
I'm just going to interject.
You walked D-Wave right into that because D-Wave is a Canadian company.
God damn it.
They're in Vancouver, the most chill city.
Thank you, Roger.
It still sounds super American, even if it's isn't.
North American.
It's North American. So then Steve says playfully, the other explanation of how this works is, pause, I don't want to talk about it. And the interesting thing is, when you do talk to people who are deep in the field, that parallel universe explanation does come up a lot. And I interviewed a number of experts when I was working on my novel because I wanted the novel to be grounded in everyday realities, or not everyday realities, and in actual
but in
technical
some reality,
realities.
Yeah,
in some form of quantum reality. And that explanation does come up repeatedly and doesn't really have an alternative. And these quantum systems sure seem to work to some degree, except they have not yet demonstrated their supremacy, but we seem to be teetering on the brink of that imminently, as we have been for some years now.
And honestly, the difference between Liam's explanation and that explanation is like explaining Schrodinger's cat at a more prosaic level and explaining it with a cat. Yes, there doesn't have to be a cat in the explanation, but it sure helps us all to kind of wrap our heads around it.
So. Yeah, and cats are sweet.
Yeah, please don't have them be dead.
Yes, indeed.
Don't open the box, I guess.
So anyway, all of this stuff, it's very hard to conceptualize. And one of the things, I think it was Einstein, and if it wasn't Einstein, it was one of the fathers of quantum computing. Einstein was always intellectually rebelling against quantum computing. But the oft-repeated joke is, if you think you understand, the clearest sign that you don't understand quantum physics in general is that you think you do. And so it one's head hurts in wrapping itself around these different issues. But Steve does a very good and accessible job of explaining these things and also explaining the raw potential that quantum computing could have in this long conversation we have. So if people who are interested in it might find that interesting.
That's at after-on.com. Patrick, you got another question before we wind up?
No, I was just going to ask if this description kind of works. We don't quite know why physics behave the way they do at the quantum level, but what we know is how they behave. We don't know why they behave like that, and we know how they behave.
A little bit like electricity. And that is,
And that is what we are harnessing to create the quantum computers. We're harnessing the statistical data and results that we can recreate reliably to use them for calculations. We just don't know why those particles behave in the way they do. We don't have the underlying physics completely figured out yet. But those behaviors, we understand that they do happen and that they happen predictably if you go to the statistical level.
Right. Well, they're spectacularly well attested. That's the thing about quantum physics is it's mind-bogglingly well attested. Experiment after experiment, validation and verification, one after another. You know, GPS wouldn't work without our understanding of quantum being implemented in physical products. Our computers wouldn't work. All the weirdness on a quantum level is basically being harnessed every, millisecond by the devices that we all use. And so weird as it is, it is as real as anything that we can establish as being real.
Well, I want to thank everybody who participates in our subreddit. We cannot know both your participation and your voting at the same time, but you can both submit and not submit stories in superposition at dailytechnewsshow.reddit.com and facebook.com/groups/dailytechnewsshow. Let's check in real quickly before we're out of here with Chris Christensen, who has an essential device for traveling.
This is Chris Christensen from Amateur Traveler with another Tech in Travel Minute. One of the things that I keep in my bag for trips is a device that is a battery that basically lets me recharge my devices, my iPhone or my iPad mini in this case. And the cool thing about this device, and this is a Hootoo device, H-O-O-T-O-O, is that it has other functionalities as well. So last week, for instance, I was in San Miguel de Allende, Mexico, staying in a house out in a casita that was far enough from the house that I couldn't get Wi-Fi. But the Hootoo device is also both a Wi-Fi extender as well as a Wi-Fi hotspot. Fortunately, there was a hotspot that was nearby that wasn't functional, but I was able to unplug the Ethernet cable, plug it into my Hootoo device, which is small enough to take with me. It's maybe half again the size of a pack of cards, that I had Wi-Fi in my room. So the Hootoo device is something I recommend that is in my kit. This is Chris Christensen from Amateur Traveler.
Hootoo para tu. Gracias, Chris Christensen, for that. And don't forget, like you said, you can find more at amateurtraveler.com. Want to read one more email before we're out of here. Ryan wrote in just a couple hours ago saying, you guys have talked quite a few times about Rob's book, After On, and just how good of a read it is. Summer's my busy season, so personal time to do any kind of leisure reading is all but off the table for me. But after hearing you talk it up so much, I caved and bought the audiobook, and I have to say, this book is incredible, with periods between every word. Since I'm typically listening in the car, I honestly have no idea what chapter I'm actually on, but I just met Maxim, and I'm learning about his complicated backstory, and have been totally captivated through the entire narrative. The complexity of the storyline, past and present entanglements between the characters, and parallels to real life, both in the things we take for granted and the conspiracies we fear but want to know nothing about, just makes this a compelling read. As a bonus, it's amusing for me to watch my wife's eyes glaze over when we're in the car and a discussion about quantum computing starts to play. If anyone out there in DTNS listener land hasn't picked this up yet, don't put it off another day. Thank you so much for taking this up, for talking this up so much. P.S. When I'm done with this book, I might have to check out the related suggested read, Pilot X, but I don't really know much about the author, so I was hoping some listeners could vouch for him. Thank you. Ryan, that was an unsolicited email. He just wrote that in, Rob.
That's very kind. And I'll add, the audiobook is really cool because it is beautifully performed by people who are not me. It is great because it has professional voice talent, including you, Tom. Tom reads a small but critical piece. But we got Felicia Day and Patrick Rothfuss and John Hodgman and a bunch of really great voices. And that's one reason why I think the audiobook delights people like Ryan. And it's very, very kind of him to say all the things he said.
Well, that is it for this episode of Daily Tech News Show. Patrick Beja, before we're out of here, what do you got going on?
Pixels. I'm going to talk about Pixels today. It's a show where I talk about video games and the video game industry. The latest episode was recorded yesterday. I cover a number of things. And the one thing I think would interest some of you guys listening is the recap of all of the many, many games that are going to be coming out until the end of the year. It's a crazy year for video games, and it's a crazy season in that crazy year. There are many games that I'm pining for, one of them being available in just a few hours. So I go over all of this. I hope you will enjoy it. It's available at frenchspin.com, and it's called Pixels.
Also, as we mentioned, not only is After On a novel, but there is a podcast. And as we've reminded you, there is an episode with Steve Jurvetson about quantum computing today. There's only a few more episodes left to come out, Rob, right?
Yeah, maybe. So it's funny you should bring that up. So I originally did this. I was thinking I was going to do 8 episodes to go deep into augmented reality, quantum computing, terrorism, and, you know, 5 other issues that are core to the book, and be able to explore them in ways I couldn't with the storyline. But it has been so much fun doing this. I've kind of been bit by the podcasting bug, so I'm giving myself 3 weeks. I've got 3 more episodes to come in my originally conceived of run. I'm giving myself 3 weeks to decide whether or not to continue with this. And so we'll see. I'm very, very tempted to keep it going. I actually injected in today's episode a request to the people who are listening to the podcast to help me decide, really. It's possible, and I had never really done this before, but it's actually remarkably easy to rate a podcast in iTunes. And so I'm asking people to rate it, because I'm going to look at every vote. That'll be one of the things that could be kind of a signal. And I'm also looking to see if the audience is growing. It seems to be growing. But if the audience continues to grow significantly over these next 3 weeks, those would be my 2 signals that, like, people really do want to hear more of this. And I'm leaning in because it has been enormous fun.
it's great to sit down with brilliant folks and talk in an unbounded way and really, really learn what they know about things that I know relatively little about, like quantum computing. So there are at least three to come, and there may be many more. I'll decide within 3 weeks.
I vote yes, on the condition that I still get to listen to the interviews early, like I have while I've been participating in this
Absolutely.
Section.
Absolutely.
Because they're really good. After-on.com. Also, thanks to everybody who gives a little value back to this show for the value they get from it. We'd like to increase that value. And here's an old friend to tell you more.
Hey, DTNS patrons, Sarah Lane here. When we hit the $20,000 milestone on Patreon, I'll be joining Tom as a regular co-host alongside the rest of the DTNS co-hosts. But that's not all. Reaching that milestone will also bring an expanded roundtable show and DTNS labs. But we need your help. Just go to patreon.com/DTNS and help us out of the amount you can and check out the cool rewards there too. Talk to you soon.
Our email address is feedback@dailytechnewsshow.com. We're live Monday through Friday, 4:30 p.m. Eastern, 20:30 UTC at alphageekradio.com and diamondclub.tv. And our website is dailytechnewsshow.com. Back tomorrow with Scott Johnson. Talk to you then.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network. Get more at frogpants.com.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Oh, that was a lovely show. Thank you, guys.
Huge fun.
Huge fun. Good.
Are we still live or live-ish?
We are still full-on video and audio live.
Awesome.
Why? Do you have secrets that you can't tell me until we
Somebody, we should take it offline. There is somebody who's quite interested in being on your show at some point.
Okay.
And I will drop the name when we're offline.
No, you just tell Elon whenever he wants.
I think he'd be really, really good. Would be a great co-host, but...
You tell Bill and Tim and Elon whenever they want.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry, Larry. Sorry, Sergey.
Or Larry and Sergey, too.
Yeah.
Although, you know, they're former employers of my wife, so I have to be careful.
I think we interviewed one of them a long time ago.
On Screensavers, yeah.
Oh, really?
Both of them, cool. Yeah. Both Larry and
Sergey. Actually, no, you're right. Both of them. It's when they ran the server out of a closet.
Whoa.
Yeah.
You interviewed them then?
No, that's when I found out about Google, is because we were bringing them on the Screensavers. Like, these two Stanford students have got this really good search engine.
Oh, my God.
I remember when Google Image came out, Scott Harriet standing around the office like, this thing's amazing.
It's really good. Ditch AltaVista, kids. This thing's great.
Oh, yeah.
Titles?
Yeah, what do we got?
We got WhatsApp needs money. Google plays in China. Essentially unfixable. I break it. Patrick dies everything. North Korean researchers, qubits, not qubits. It does not and does not. Sounds more cute. The thing about qubits, it sounds a lot like Qbert. It does not and doesn't have to be a cat. China plays nice with Google Play. China allows Google to play a quantum of supremacy.
Nice.
The quantum supremacy starring Matt Damon. WhatsApp with your business. Ready, Android One. Tom, how's it going, Roger? Roger, good.
It's become your bit now.
You know, I think it would be a tragedy to not give a shout out to the coolest name I have ever heard in my life, T2T2.
Oh, yeah. He's our Estonian.
Oh, so T2T2 is a regular Estonian.
I will not try to pronounce his name, but they both begin with T's.
He's a regular... person in our chat room.
Yeah, he runs the chat room. The chat room runs on his servers.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
The T2T2 and Hutu was later mentioned.
Right.
There's a fun alliteration play to be made.
Hutu, Hutu, T2.
We're getting into
shockingly true stories. Mario has retired.
These are not the Estonians you're looking for.
Explaining it with a cat.
I like qubits, not qubits. It's a written title.
It's cool.
Yeah.
It's fun.
We'll go with that. Any dissenters? Too late.
Motion carried. All right.
Wow. I learned how our government works.
We got our we got our title before I even finished levelating.
Levelating. Dun 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 dun.
Is that part Wonder Woman, that tune there?
Yes.
Knew I recognized it.
Level 80.
I really loved this episode. Not that I don't love all the episodes equally.
Equally.
Are you going to put hugs and kisses at the end of the show notes? Love. What is love?
Emotional. Sounds like a dance hit.
Mm-hmm.
What is love?
Yeah,
Hadaway.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It was used in the to great effect in the SNL skit with Chris Kattan and Will Ferrell when they play the Roxy Boy, like the clubbers.
That I was not aware of. You know, you've sent me to YouTube as soon as this is off.
To the YouTube.
You've never seen the movie Night at the Roxbury? It's based on that skit.
No, I haven't. I'm kind of movie illiterate. It's embarrassing.
That's fine. I am pop music illiterate.
I have embarrassing holes in my movie literacy as well, which is why we've started doing the Current Geek Film Fest.
Ooh.
Where we're watching in reverse order the top 100 movies of all time, as determined by some cross-referencing of multiple lists. And we started with
starting with 100 and working your way to the top.
No, we're starting with number one and then going backwards. So we watched The Godfather.
Some would say going from 1 to 100 is in the normal order.
Yeah. I guess you're right. Well, I was thinking you normally count down.
Yeah, yeah, so, I know.
Yeah, yeah.
So what was number one? What was number one?
The Godfather.
All right.
So we watched
that. And so that's good because if you run out of steam, then you'll have seen the good shit. Right?
Yeah.
Did I say the wrong word?
No, that's fine.
Wait, so I'm curious, what's number 100?
I have to look.
The Hangover 9.
No, there's really good movies that don't make it into the top 100. I cross-referenced inevitably. Rotten Tomatoes, American Film Institute, and IMDb's rankings. And number 100 is Interstellar.
Wow.
Oh, that is
the 100th best movie. I got to admit, that is entirely accurate.
It's good and flawed in some ways.
Yeah.
Right? That's your 100 right there.
It's so funny. When I first heard about the movie Interstellar, I was mistaking it for Interspace. It's like, why are they remaking
Interspace?
That movie?
Like, wasn't with, that Dana Carvey?
Not Randy Quaid. Who's the other Quaid?
Dennis Quaid?
Dennis Quaid. Yeah, Dennis Quaid and...
okay, this is how you start a bar fight, though, especially
and
in
Los Angeles. I had thought they had finally made a movie version of the Beastie Boys hit Intergalactic. So I too was confused.
Also disappointed. Yeah. Number 101 is Rashomon, behind Interstellar.
What is it?
Rashomon.
Rashomon.
You know what? I don't know. Can you do that? Can you really pick him?
Number 99, Annie Hall.
Ooh, you're doing this formally? Is this like another podcast? You have 900 podcasts.
No, I'm doing it as part of Current Geek. This is my new sneaky way of doing different podcasts, is to do them as part of existing podcasts. So we may do it once a month. We haven't quite decided. But the idea is, instead of doing our normal Current Geek interviews, Scott and I will just watch a movie and talk about it. And we did Godfather this past Friday. And the show went great. Cool. We got some good feedback from it as well.
You know, Scott Sigler is doing something. Our mutual friend, Sigler, is doing this thing where they're basically, they have somebody on who brings up a movie, their favorite movie, or just something from the archives, and they basically have a long conversation about it. I was on and we had talked about a movie that I adore called Shallow Grave, which is far too obscure. It's Danny Boyle, who later did Slumdog Millionaire and Trainspotting and other things, but it was his first movie. And we just had a really fun conversation. And so they're doing this weekly. You might enjoy listening to this.
Yeah.
It's a fun little podcast.
No, I love both those people. So I can't imagine I wouldn't enjoy hearing them talk about movies. That's another reason is that I want shows where the prep isn't reading more stories, but where I can just watch a movie. And then we're not setting ourselves up as the experts on the movie. We're like, okay, we're just normal people and we watched this movie that's supposedly amazing. Here's what we thought about it.
That's cool.
Yeah. We're supposedly normal people, allegedly.
All right. So have any of you watched the After Hours, Martin Scorsese movie?
No.
No. What's After Hours about?
Is that number 97 or something?
No, so it's one of the. It's kind of weird because it's my first Martin Scorsese movie I ever watched, but no one knows about it, and I've always wondered why.
Oh, yeah. I've seen. No, I saw it when I. It's the guy who goes down to Greenwich Village and he runs. Yeah, his $20 bill flies out of the back.
Exactly.
I saw that a long time ago.
Trying to get back home.
I didn't know that was Martin Scorsese. Because it's kind of a flighty movie, and I think of him as doing really, really serious stuff for the most part. Like, it's kind of goofy, right?
Raising the Dead, which was kind of crossing that line.
Oh, I didn't see that.
It had Nicolas Cage in it.
Oh, he did a great movie. He did a great concert movie, Shine a Light with the Rolling Stones. Is one of the better concert movies.
So many movies.
Made in Estonia is a movie that exists, says T2T2.
Is it M-A-D-E or M-A-I-D?
M-A-D-E, yes.
M-A-D-E, because M-A-I-D, yeah. It would be a different kind of movie, probably.
My friend Ron Richards and Connor Kilpatrick and friends did a podcast series called The Goodfellas Minute. Each episode... they talked about one 60-second slice of Goodfellas.
God, that's obsessive. I remember talking to Ron about that. It just sounded very Ron, actually. Yeah.
Well, and he got the idea from the Star Wars Minute, which is people who did that with Star Wars.
Oh, got it. I didn't realize. Well, that makes sense. Okay.
It's just such a great idea.
You know, it's weird because Ray Liotta is one of those, I don't want to say character actors, but an actor you associate with kind of mob. Or like Long Island, New Jersey, like that movies, contemporary movies. And it's the weirdest thing because he shows up, and this is totally nothing to do with Goodfellas. He shows up in a movie called The Name of the King, which is based on a Microsoft RPG game, and it has a Jason Statham in it. But he plays like an evil sorcerer, and he still keeps his accent. He doesn't try to change it. It's like the weirdest, like incongruent thing in the movie where you're just totally jarred out. Like, what?
That's funny.
Speaking with this really thick accent, it's just like, what? Well, it's not super thick, but it's noticeable. And I think it's just
A little bit like Sean Connery in Highlander plays a Spaniard, but just talks like Sean Connery. Because he's been in Scotland so long, right?
Yeah. What's the Streetcar Named Desire? What's his name?
Tennessee Ernie Ford?
No, the actor, Marlon Brando.
Brando, yeah, of course.
Where he's in Superman, and he's just like kind of doing
Marlon Brando, yeah.
He's Marlon Brando, and I sent you. My son. It's like it's kind of odd. That's totally what it sounds like
on the day of my planet's eruption.
I send them you.
That was one of the things we talked about with The Godfather: is how many quotes from The Godfather aren't in The Godfather? Because you know it's that Shakespeare effect where. You know, there's madness to his method is not in Shakespeare. It's though this be madness, there is method in it. And I can't remember the exact quotes, but The Godfather, you come to me on the day of my daughter's wedding asking for a favor, is not what he says. He says, you come to me on this, the day my daughter is getting married or something like that. And then later says, I want you to do me a service. He doesn't even use the word favor.
But an offer you can't refuse is from The Godfather, right?
Oh, yeah. Several people say it.
So that is an authentic quote.
That one's word for word.
Yeah. What's the other one? Go ahead, make my day is not from Dirty Harry, right? That's not from Dirty Harry. It's another Clint Eastwood movie where he's a cop.
Oh, really? He doesn't say make my day Dirty at all. Harry. Huh?
I could be wrong. You know, another thing, Yogi Berra, it was apparently mute because every quote I've ever heard attributed to Yogi Berra has been snoped out of his. utterances. It's really disappointing because I used to think of him as just being the most, you know, kind of like anarchic wit.
Oh,
you
no
know,
kidding.
Like a really brilliant guy who was messing with people by saying things that seemed wrong, but they were so cleverly, precisely wrong. It's like, oh my God, but like everything I've ever heard that he had said. So I kind of think he may not have ever spoken.
Go ahead, make my day is from the movie Sudden Impact.
Sudden Impact. It's really? part of the sets of movies with the same character, Harry Callahan. But the first movie, Dirty Harry, he doesn't actually say that. It takes
It is the same character.
So Dirty Harry says it. He just doesn't say it in Dirty Harry. Yeah.
Got it. And Sudden Impact is the one where Dirty Harry, uses his pistol to stop the asteroid from hitting the Earth, right? That was right. Deep Impact. That
no,
was
no,
deep.
That's no. Dante's Impact.
Yeah.
Armageddon Kano.
Man, when Armageddon and Deep Impact came out at the same time, I was just wondering what kind of pissing match happened where some guy was just like, dude, you're going to make an asteroid run crash into the Earth.
But it happened with Volcano and Dante's Impact, or Dante's Peak, and it happened with Red Planet and A Journey to Mars.
And with, there were like tsunami movies. Twister. Like 2012 and...
Can't remember. Right. Yeah. The earthquake disaster movies, yeah. Mm.
It's kind of difficult to...
This goes way back. I mean, Chaucer was totally bummed when he came out with the Canterbury Tales, and like the same week the Decameron came out.
Well, yeah, and even before that, Matthew was like, what, Mark? I just put out the same story. Luke, you too?
Almost identical. Almost word for word. It's just,
At least John did a spin on his.
Yeah.
We're not even alive at the same time, but somehow...
All right. Thanks everybody for watching. I'm going to find out all of the secrets now. And again, a huge, huge thank you. I know we haven't talked about it a lot in the post show, but we have made so much progress since we announced the new milestone on Friday to getting Sarah Lane on the show. I feel really positive about this. We only have, just about $2,500 to go, just a little bit more than that. So thank you for your support. And if you are meaning to add support, please do. We've got some great new rewards in there. We got a bunch of people at the new advisor level. So go check it out. Patreon.com/DTNS. Goodbye, everybody. And patrons, thank you for your continuing support.